An influential investor in the bookstore chain Borders is proposing that his company take over the rival Barnes & Noble. So our last word in business today is Barnes & Borders, or Noble Borders, or BB&N. All could be possible names for a merged bookstore chain.
Unfortunately, there's already a private school with the BB&N name.
James McQuivey is a media business analyst at Forrester Research.
That does sound very much like a bank, though, and maybe that'll be their new business model. They already have your credit card on file.
Or the new company could start with a clean page.
And just call it Libro or something very friendly.
And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
We're joined now by Austin Goolsbee. He's the chairman of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. Austin Goolsbee, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
In an interview with the New York Times just last week, you were asked about the possibility of extending the Bush tax rates for the wealthy. You said, and I quote here, "I personally do not think that we can afford to borrow $700 billion to pay for tax cuts we know don't work." If we can't afford it, as you say, then why do it?
Well, the $700 billion obviously was for making them permanent, which the president absolutely refused to do and did not do. He's opposed to extending the high-income tax cuts. They don't work. But if by doing that you can get 2.5 times as much for the priorities that the Obama administration outlined of getting additional Obama tax cuts for the middle class, and you can extend unemployment benefits for more than a year, I really don't see how you could pass up that deal.
But it is, I mean, you have to be looking at it as a risk as well to some extent. I mean, what if it doesn't work? I mean, aren't there potentially dangerous consequences for both long and medium-term deficits?
As I've said many times, the conflating of the long-run fiscal challenges facing the country with the short-run deficit that is induced by being in the worst recession since 1929 is deeply, deeply problematic. We should not be conflating those two things. That is totally incorrect. The Fiscal Commission, which took a very hard line on long-run fiscal consolidation, the commission made clear that has no implication for the immediate run. This stuff is not about the long run deficit.
But how convinced are you that this will actually work? I mean, what if it doesn't do what it's intended to do?
Look, when you are at war, you fire the bullets that you have. And we need to do everything we can for targeted job creation, helping the middle class get out of this deep hole.
Austin Goolsbee, as we just heard from Jim McDermott, a Democrat from Washington State, many congressional Democrats are arguing that the administration's notion of compromise is, you know, effectively agreeing to what the Republicans want. The conservative magazine, The National Review, had a gleeful editorial today calling it a capitulation. Do you believe that the White House got the best possible deal from congressional Republicans?
Well, look, go pick up the fact sheet on what the agreement is. And it is totally obvious that it is not the president capitulating only to what the Republicans wanted.
So what explains so much opposition from congressional Democrats, including Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who has said that from his perspective, the framework needs work, that this is not a done deal?
Well, I mean, obviously you're selectively picking opponents.
Well, Harry Reid is the Senate Majority Leader.
Well, as I say, you can select any individuals you want to select. What I would say is there are some people who would have preferred to have a fight. I believe if you look at the facts, we would likely have had a fight, and then in 2 months when Republicans come into Congress, they would have passed the high-income tax cuts, and we would not have gotten the 2.5 times the high-income tax cuts in middle-class priorities and job-creating investment incentives, as well as the unemployment benefits that the president wanted. So I think there was just a decision that had to be made on that front.
Austin Goolsbee, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Austin Goolsbee. He's the chairman of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors.
Things considered, right after this.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The president is expected to speak at a news conference a little later this hour. When he does, we'll join him. The issues are expected to include the tax cut deal and WikiLeaks. But first, most of us spent Thanksgiving with family, friends, and a steadily diminishing turkey. NPR science correspondent was in the Gulf of Mexico to look for the oil from the BP spill. The well itself was finally capped a few months ago, but not before more than 4 million barrels of crude gushed into the water. Richard went along with scientists who believe that much of that oil sank to the bottom of the sea, and they brought along the famous mini-sub Alvin to go half a mile down to the bottom and take a look. If you'd like to know what they found there at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, what it looks like, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Richard Harris, kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Welcome home.
Thank you very much.
And what did you find at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico?
We found, well, depending upon where we looked, on my particular dive, we found a fairly thin layer of brown material that was sitting on the bottom. In some places, it looked thicker and fluffy like cottage cheese, but still brown. And I also saw it smeared all over a beautiful old, maybe 500-year-old sea fan. And it was a coral that was apparently killed by this brown material. Exactly what that material is still being investigated right now. Clearly, it wasn't there before the oil spill. As far as biologists studying the Gulf say, they've never seen something like this before. It's probably, almost certainly not pure oil. However, oil has had a chance to get digested by microbes and sea life. There's probably some oil, though, still in it. It's clearly the carbon in that material almost certainly came from the BP well. But what the material is remains to be figured out in a lab.
So you were out on a ship in the Gulf of Mexico, what, about 10 miles away from the Macondo well, which is the source of the spill?
That's correct. We were on the research vessel Atlantis, which is the mothership for the Alvin from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And a couple days after Thanksgiving, I actually did dive about 10 miles from the oil well. Subsequent dives and other samples were taken much closer. We went right past, practically right over the site of the oil spill, and took samples from there as well, off of the Atlantis, and also the Alvin did as well. And there, this mud layer, which sort of looks like chocolate pudding, was a couple of inches thick when they brought up these core samples. We looked at it in the laboratory aboard the ship. The organisms in the mud had been killed off by this, either because they were maybe suffocated by the material, or possibly there's toxic materials within this brown mucky layer. But worms that tried to get out were just essentially unable to keep surviving in that brown guck.
There are any number of other sea creatures that then feed on those worms, no?
That's true. It's a complicated story and a complicated ecosystem, because I should also mention that we saw fish that looked like they were doing just fine, and shrimp and so on. So organisms that live above the seafloor, depending upon how dependent upon they were on life under the seafloor, were maybe doing better. Some of the crabs looked sickly to Samantha Joy, who is one of the scientists from the University of Georgia, who was actually the leader of this expedition. We actually ended up capturing one of those crabs, and she's taking it back to a laboratory to have it examined more closely. But it was a female crab that had where you'd sort of expect to see eggs wrapped around under her tail. It was some sort of strange brown material. So these were crabs that were discolored and had bumps on them, and they did not look like happy campers.
How long does this chemical analysis of this chocolate pudding take?
It'll probably take a couple of months based on what we saw last time, because Samantha Joy was out here in September, and she was taking core samples of this mud at the time, and those results came back just essentially as she was heading out to sea again in November.
So we've heard any number of explanations for what happened to those millions of barrels of crude oil that gushed into the water. Some of it was evaporated, the lighter materials. Some of it was, we are told, eaten by bacteria.
Yes, and this is potentially evidence that some of it was eaten by bacteria. The one scenario for where this brown gut came from was that the oil saturated the water, and there are oil-eating bacteria out there, and they consume some of it. And then sort of if you can think of an algae bloom causing sometimes serious problems in bays, you could sort of think of this as an oil bloom, as one of the scientists on board told me. It's like, and the bacteria, you know, expanded rapidly. The organisms that eat bacteria expanded rapidly, and so rapidly that some of their fecal material may have ended up on the seafloor. Some of their skeletons could have ended up in their bodies if they were killed by this sort of gorging of oil. And that may be a significant fraction of this brown goop.
We know that there are oil-eating bacteria there because oil seeps naturally out of the floor, the seafloor at the Gulf of Mexico. There's lots of places it does, and that's what they do. They've evolved to eat that oil. But this was they had a very large Thanksgiving dinner, so to speak.
Yes, we went to one of these natural seeps. Actually, I dived near one of these natural seeps, and possibly over 20,000 years, one of the scientists estimated, maybe this seep, which has been around that long, may have produced as much oil as came out of the BP well in a couple of months. So yes, they are adapted to oil, some organisms, but they're certainly not adapted to dealing with an enormous quantity all at once. And that's one of the fundamental questions that they're trying to figure out here. How well can these natural systems respond to it? How much can we just count on Mother Nature to take care of this for us? And how much are we actually killing some of these organisms that we are turning to and hoping to clean up the mess for us?
We're talking with NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Again, in about 8 minutes or so, the president is expected to come out to hold a news conference in the White House briefing room. Again, the issues are likely to include the tax cut deal with Republicans and WikiLeaks, among other things. So stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, if you'd like to know what Richard and the scientists saw at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Dan is on the line from Sarasota in Florida.
Hi. I'm wondering that in your lab tests, whether you can recreate the conditions and the pressures at the bottom of the ocean, and is there a way to test that oil dispersant mixing with the oil and whether the pressures change the way it reacts with the oil, and maybe that's what you got down there.
That's an excellent question. I think that there is a great deal of interest among the scientists on board about how much of this material might actually be the result of the dispersants that were used. These are chemicals that break up oil and may have kept a lot of the oil off the shoreline, but it almost certainly kept a lot of the oil in the water, and the dispersants themselves are toxic. So there's a critical question about, you know, is this brown muck maybe partially dispersant, and they don't know. I think the lab tests are not so much trying to recreate this as to understand what are the constituents of this brown muck, how much of it is sort of still recognizable as oily compounds that would have come straight from the well, how much is actually digested carbon that had already been through numerous digestive systems of marine organisms along the way. But clearly the dispersants are of great interest to this group. And
would those, do you think there, or have they tested whether or not those dispersants mixed with the oil might actually prevent the bacteria from digesting the oil? And maybe that's what we've got here. Maybe that dispersant mixed with the oil killed the bacteria.
Or it just makes it taste bad.
Yeah, an excellent question, and I don't know the answer.
Dan, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Do we have any idea how widespread this area of, varying from a thin layer of cottage cheese to a thick layer of chocolate pudding, how big this area is?
That's also a difficult question to answer because it's spotty. What we discovered and the scientists on this is that they found a little bit everywhere they looked, but some places it was really thick, some places it was pretty thin. We were diving out 10 miles away from the Macondo well, and it was a thin layer there. There are places, one assumption is that a lot of this could have fallen out wherever the giant sort of the oil on the surface of the water fell. So as remember the satellite pictures, that actually flowed pretty far to the north and towards the shores of, you know, Mississippi and Florida and so on. And so Alabama. So it's possible that, and it's reasonable to expect that some of this oil would have fallen to the seafloor in those areas. But it's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of square miles and maybe thousands of square miles that were under the oil, and the operating assumption, the hypothesis being tested, is that wherever the oil was on the surface, you should probably find it on the bottom.
Andrew's on the line calling from Nashville.
Yeah, I'm interested to know if we have truly seen the worst. This sounds kind of rosy in some ways, much better than we all anticipated maybe months ago. But is there a scenario in which we could still see some kind of ecosystem collapse due to this kind of chocolate pudding, as you described it, on the seafloor or other other things that are going to ultimately disrupt the ecosystem?
Yeah, well, I think this could be very hard on the organisms that live in the mud on the seafloor, and I think that we shouldn't paint a rosy picture of what life is like at the seafloor for those organisms. I think it remains to be seen what is going to happen elsewhere. I mean, you can see large fish right now. What we don't really know about is fish larvae. Fish start out as these tiny little points of life that move around in the sea and grow fairly slowly, and those are susceptible to both poisoning from oil and oil dispersants as well. And we simply don't know. Maybe 5 or 10 years down the road, when we would expect to see a whole new crop of fish, we will discover that the fish larvae that were in the Gulf last spring and summer didn't get a chance to grow. And so that is that. I'm not saying that happened, but if you're asking, are there potentially less rosy scenarios? That's certainly a scenario that fisheries biologists are very concerned about. What is life going to be like? And that includes some tuna and other fish that we care a lot about.
Andrew, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks.
And Richard, I know you're in the process of producing some pieces that we're going to be hearing later this week on All Things Considered, Morning Edition.
All Things Considered, yeah.
And so we'll look forward to that. But tell us what it was like. Not very many of us get to go down into a research submarine that's, big enough to fit 3 people?
Yeah, that's right. It was very cozy. It's cold. It's a small space. Three people in there. If you try to stretch out, you're rubbing knees or whatever with one another. It's a space. They're small windows. There are about 3 windows that are 6 inches across or something that you can peer out. And there are also cameras. I spent most of my time looking out the window as opposed to through the cameras. But the cameras brought back all sorts of high definition video and so on. And it went remarkably quickly. It was very. I thought, is it going to be scary going a half a mile down under the ocean? And the answer was no. It was remarkably peaceful. It was, the light sort of faded to black, and then we saw these glowing organisms out the windows, these bioluminescent bacteria and so on. And it was a magical descent. I almost forgot that we were going down sort of to look at the scene of a crime practically, but because it was such a mesmerizing experience getting down there.
Richard Harris, thanks very much for your time. And again, we'll look forward to pieces further describing your adventures on the seafloor at the Gulf of Mexico. Appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris joined us here in Studio 3A. When we come back, we'll get you ready for the President's News Conference. He's scheduled to get underway in just a couple of minutes now. Again, topics will include the agreement yesterday with Republicans on the tax cut extension and also WikiLeaks. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
One of the great experiences of Paris is browsing the booksellers along the banks of the Seine. Many of the booksellers are now selling tourist souvenirs, which they say brings in more money than the books. In an effort to protect a cherished tradition, City Hall is cracking down on license holders, and Eleanor Beardsley sends us this report from Paris.
If you've ever strolled along the Seine River, you've surely walked past the booksellers and their stalls. Known as bouquinistes, these often crusty old characters sell old books, rare posters, and historic memorabilia out of green wooden boxes mounted on the walls alongside the river. But increasingly, the bouquinistes are forced to peddle less lofty merchandise to make ends meet. Amongst the literature at André Paul's stall are Eiffel Tower keychains and drink coasters printed with impressionist scenes.
Just because we're in the business of selling culture doesn't mean we shouldn't be able to make a living at it. It's hard work being out here in the weather and with the traffic noise. So sometimes we have to compromise and sell a few trinkets along with our books.
There are about 250 bouquinistes along the Seine. Each has 4 boxes loaned to them for free by the city of Paris. In exchange, bouquinistes are allowed to fill only 1 box with tourist mementos. Paris City Hall recently launched a competition to attract new bouquinistes to stalls that had lain empty. About 300 candidates applied for 30 slots. Lynn Cohen-Solel, deputy mayor in charge of commerce, explains why it's so important to find the right candidates.
For Paris, it's something very important to have real professional people as bookinists and not all lay people coming there just to make money.
Many bookinists are former professors or journalists and often specialize in a certain genre. Alain Huchet sells cookbooks and old menus. He pulls out a restaurant menu from a dinner held in 1871 during the Prussian siege of Paris when hundreds of people starved to death.
J'ai les menus du siège de Paris, quand on a mangé tous les animaux du jardin des plantes pendant le siège.
They ate the zoo animals, including the last elephant. They also ate rats and cats. And here are some beans made with dog meat.
The first bouquiniste in Paris opened his stall in the 1600s. In 1802, Napoleon Bonaparte placed them on the banks of the Seine and began to regulate the trade. Today, 3.5 miles of the riverbank are decorated with the watertight, dark green boxes. As Deputy Mayor Cohen Solel puts it, Paris is the only city whose river runs through two bookshelves. Jean-Pierre Mathias is a 25-year veteran of the bouquiniste trade. He is opening his stalls for the day's business. He holds a prestigious spot across from France's great literary institution, the Académie Française. Mathias's wife, who is also a bouquiniste, has a place in the more touristy section near Notre Dame Cathedral, he says. But the couple manages to make a living at it and raise two small children. Mathias says you can't compromise on your principles, though.
Les Chinois disent, bon, s'il y a quelque chose qui se vend, on a qu'à le copier.
Mass tourism means you get the same thing everywhere, and we booksellers are suffering from an invasion of Chinese copies. But I'm here to raise the cultural level and to meet the demands of people who are looking for something specific.
Mathias says everything he sells is original. He doesn't offer plastic miniature reproductions of the Moulin Rouge like some of his neighbors.
Ça c'est Moulin Rouge, mais ça c'est l'époque.
But he does have a complete set of circa 1950 original programs from the Moulin Rouge nightclub. I'm one of the only ones to have the entire collection, he says. They're very rare. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
It's the only program where you can hear about booksellers, a famous river, and dog meat, all in the same story. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
An absolute wake-up call for America. That's how Education Secretary Arne Duncan views the results of an international standardized test in which U.S. students ranked from 15th to 25th worldwide in science, reading, and math. At the top of the list are students from Shanghai, with Hong Kong and Singapore not far behind. The test is called the Program for International Student Assessment, or PISA. It's given to 15-year-old students by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And senior analyst Michael Davidson joins us to talk about it. He helped to compile and analyze the results. Mr. Davidson, welcome.
Good, thank you.
Let's look a little more closely at the U.S. student scores. Of these three subjects, U.S. students did best on reading, tied with Poland and Liechtenstein, if I'm reading this right.
That's correct, yeah. On reading, around the OECD average, in fact, but yes, tied to those countries you mentioned.
Okay, and not so strong, though, in science and in math. Below average in math, tied with Ireland.
That's right. Mathematics is really of the three areas where the US falls furthest short of the OECD average.
Mr. Davidson, when you look at the top performers, Shanghai, Finland, Hong Kong, Singapore, what are they doing right? Are there common practices that seem to be making their students come up at the top of the pack?
Well, there is. This is the first time that actually we've been able to track progress over time. And what we've been able to do is look at not just what features they have in the system, but how these may have changed. So some of the common features, just to give you a flavour, they all have well-established educational standards. They have goals that everybody aspires to reach. And they also, a crucial thing, and this is particularly true in Finland, they recruit their teachers from the top 5, 6, 10% of graduates from each year. So they bring the best people into the teaching profession, which isn't true in many countries, indeed most countries.
And when you look at the U.S. student scores, what would you say the lessons are for educators in this country, looking at U.S. students ranking barely above average, in some categories below average, way below average in math?
Well, I think one of the striking things that comes from the US set of data is the impact that social background has on your success in education within the United States. Something like 20% of the performance differences that we see in the United States is attributed to the social background of the students. and that's higher than across the OECD on average.
When you talk about social background or social divisions being an impediment here, what are you talking about?
One of the things that we find is that the resources are not equitably distributed. That could be financial resources, it could be the quality of the teachers. We also have a statistic which examines the proportion of resilient students. Now, these are students who achieve higher than you would expect given their social background. In the most successful countries like Korea, Shanghai, Singapore, those proportions are something like 70%. In the US, it's below 30%.
If you were to talk, Mr. Davidson, to top leaders, politicians in this country, is there any way, do you think, to read these results other than that the U.S. is falling way behind and that could have really dire consequences for competition in the global marketplace?
I think the price of this is huge. We know that underachievement costs the economy a significant amount of money. And tackling that underachievement is a priority, not just for the education system, but for the economy and society at large.
Well, Mr. Davidson, thanks very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Michael Davidson speaking with us from Paris. He is senior analyst with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which created the International Test.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.